Good morning and welcome to Flight Logic Brief. It's Monday, June 15th, 2026, and we've got a packed rundown for you this morning. I'm Alex.
And I'm Sam. And Alex, can I just say, we've got one of those mornings where the lead story is basically an industry food fight. I love it.
It really is. We've got the major airframe makers throwing cold water on a technology that two startups are absolutely convinced is the future. We've got business aviation consolidating again, an airport in Dubai that's rewriting the rulebook, and a couple of safety stories I think every one of you flying the line is going to want to hear.
And a Cirrus engine that came apart in flight. We'll get there.
We will get there. So let's start at the top, with the story that had San Diego buzzing last week. So at the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics annual convention in San Diego, we had a genuine public debate break out over blended wing body aircraft. And for anyone who hasn't been tracking it, blended wing body, or BWB, is that design where the fuselage and the wing sort of merge into one big lifting surface. No conventional tube with wings bolted on the side. The whole thing is the wing.
Right. It looks like a manta ray. And the pitch has always been efficiency, right? You get more lift out of the body, less drag, and the promise is something like 20, maybe 30% better fuel burn than a comparable tube and wing jet.
That's the promise. And the two companies carrying the flag here are JetZero and Nautilus, both California startups. They were at this convention essentially making the case that this is ready for prime time, it's heading toward certification and revenue service, and that the only reason we don't already have these flying is that the big guys won't build them.
And that's the part that got spicy, because their argument, and I'm paraphrasing here, is basically that Airbus and Boeing are deliberately avoiding the radical technology to protect their existing product lines. To protect the investment in the conventional jets they're already selling.
Which is a pretty pointed accusation.
It's a huge accusation, and what's interesting is Airbus, Boeing, and Liam News' own analysis are all on the skeptical side here. So you've got the two manufacturers who actually have to certify and support these things in service, plus an analyst shop that's pretty hard-nosed about the numbers, all saying, hold on, we're not so sure the benefits are what you say they are.
So what's the substance of the skepticism? Because they're protecting their turf is an easy thing to say.
Well, here's the thing. And this is where I actually come down closer to the skeptics with respect to the startups. The blended wing body has real known problems that nobody solved at scale. Start with the pressurized cabin. A tube is a beautiful pressure vessel. It's round, the loads distribute evenly, it's structurally efficient. A flattened blended body is not round, so pressurizing it means a much heavier structure to handle those loads. And weight eats your efficiency gains.
So some of that 20-30% gets clawed back just in structure.
Potentially a lot of it. Then there's the passenger experience. In a wide blended cabin, people sitting far from the center line, when that aircraft rolls into a turn, they move vertically a lot more than you do in a narrow tube. You can actually make people sick. There's no windows for most seats. Evacuation is a nightmare to certify because you've got this wide cabin and the geometry of getting people out in 90 seconds gets really hard.
And from our audience's perspective, the corporate and airline crews, the operational side matters too. Ground handling, gate compatibility.
Exactly. You've designed an airplane that doesn't fit the infrastructure that exists at every airport on Earth. So even if it flew perfectly, where does it park? How do you board it? How do you de-ice it? These are not small questions.
Now, to be fair to JetZero and Nautilus, the counterargument is that every one of those problems is an engineering problem, not a physics problem. And the incumbents said similar things about composites, about fly-by-wire.
That's true, and that's the strongest version of their case. And Nautilus is going at it from the freight side first, which is smart, because a cargo blended wing body doesn't have to worry about passengers feeling queasy or window views. You just need volume and efficiency. So I think the freighter path is genuinely more credible than the passenger path in the near term.
And why does this matter to someone flying a Part 121 line or a corporate flight department today? This is years out.
It matters because fleet planning is a 15-20-year decision. If you're an operator or you're advising on acquisition strategy, you have to make a bet right now about whether the tube and wing you're committing to is going to look obsolete in 2040. And what this San Diego debate tells me is the people who actually build airplanes are betting it won't. They're saying conventional configuration plus better engines plus sustainable fuel is the realistic path. The radical airframe is still a maybe.
So your read is the skeptics have the better of it for now.
For now. But I'd love to be wrong because that manta ray is gorgeous and the planet could use the fuel savings.
Well said. Let's bring it back down to business aviation, where where the news is less about radical airframes and more about who owns whom. So Flexjet, one of the largest fractional operators out there, has acquired the jet business. And the jet business, for those who don't know it, is that prominent London-based brokerage and pre-owned aircraft sales operation. They're famous, actually, for that showroom with the giant interactive screens. Steve Varsano's outfit.
Yeah, the guy who built basically a showroom for jets the way you'd have a car dealership, except the cars are $40 million globals. So this is Flexjet doing vertical integration, right? They're pulling brokerage and pre-owned sales capability in-house.
That's the move. Flexjet sits on top of one of the largest operator bases in business aviation, and now they own a piece of the buying and selling pipeline, plus interior and aircraft services capability.
And this is the consolidation story we keep coming back to. Every few weeks, it's another piece of the independent ecosystem getting absorbed into one of the big platforms. And I want to flag what that means for the independent operator and the fractional user, because it's a double-edged thing.
How so?
On the one hand, integration can mean a smoother experience. One company handles your aircraft, your interior, your transaction. On the other hand, every time one of these independent shops gets bought, the menu of independent options shrinks. If you're a small flight department that liked having a neutral broker who wasn't tied to a big operator's interests, there's a little less of that available every year.
And speaking of services capability, there's a related story out of the maintenance world. ExecuJet MRO Services, which operates under the Lux Aviation Group, just completed a major upgrade on a Dassault Falcon 7X.
And this is the part I actually find encouraging, because the headline this day is buy new, buy new. But ExecuJet just demonstrated that a midlife Falcon 7X can be brought up to modern standard through a major upgrade. Maintenance, repair, and overhaul, MRO. That's not glamorous, but it's the whole business case for keeping legacy iron flying.
And the 7X is a serious airplane. Trijet, fly-by-wire, long-range. There are a lot of them out there in corporate fleets.
Tons of them. And if you're a flight department weighing a $60 or $70 million new acquisition against upgrading the very capable airplane you already own, and no, this kind of completion work is exactly the alternative that keeps you from writing that enormous check. The viability of the midlife upgrade is a real strategic lever, and I don't think it gets enough attention next to all the shiny new deliveries.
Right. The airplane you already operate is the airplane your crews are already typed and current on. There's value in that continuity.
Huge value. Training, familiarity, dispatch reliability you already understand, don't discount it.
Let's stay in the business aviation world, but go further afield. Way further, to Africa. So the African Business Aviation Association, AFBAA, has kicked off a multi-phase research initiative to, in their words, better understand business aviation across the African continent. And the first phase is looking at fleet, economic, and maintenance analysis.
And this sounds dry, but I think it's genuinely important, and here's why. Africa is one of the few places left where business aviation isn't a luxury, it's infrastructure. When you don't have reliable airline networks connecting secondary cities, when ground transport between countries is difficult, a business jet or a turboprop isn't a perk. It's how commerce actually moves.
And yet there's never really been a comprehensive data-driven picture of the activity.
That's the gap. They're calling it the first comprehensive portrait of business aviation activity across the continent. And data is what unlocks everything downstream. You want manufacturers to support the region. You want insurers to price risk fairly. You want maintenance providers to invest in facilities. You want regulators to harmonize rules. None of that happens without somebody first counting the airplanes and understanding the economics.
So this is foundational work rather than a headline event.
It's plumbing, but good plumbing. And if you fly internationally into that region or your department is even thinking about it, the fact that there's going to be better fleet and maintenance data coming should make planning a little less of a guessing game over the next few years.
All right, let's shift gears and get into the wider commercial and operational world, because Simple Flying had a stack of stories this week, and there's a lot here that matters for crews. Let's start with infrastructure, because the scale of this one is just staggering. Dubai is building out Al Maktoum International, also called Dubai World Central, and the expansion is approved at almost $35 billion. 400 gates. And here's the kicker, Sam. Every single one of those 400 gates is engineered to Code F.
Everyone. So for the listeners, Code F is the airport design standard for the biggest aircraft, the Airbus A380 category. We're talking a 262-foot wingspan. And normally, even at the big hubs, you have a handful of CodeF stands and the rest are sized smaller, because CodeF gates are expensive and they eat up real estate.
Right. You don't make every gate fit your largest airplane because most of your traffic is narrow bodies.
Exactly. So Dubai deciding that all 400 positions can take an A380 without borrowing space from the gate next door, that's a massive, expensive flexibility play. What they're buying is the ability to put any airplane at any gate, anytime. No Tetris. No, sorry, the only A380-capable stand is occupied. For a hub that's built its entire identity on Emirates and the Super Jumbo, it makes sense, but it's an enormous bet on the large aircraft staying relevant.
Which is interesting, given the A380 is out of production.
That's the tension, isn't it? They're building maximum size infrastructure for an airplane nobody's making anymore. But the counter-argument is, gates last 50 years, and you'd rather have the capability and not need it than need it and not have it. And it future-proofs them for whatever large aircraft comes next.
Let's go from the biggest airport story to a fleet modernization story closer to home. Alaska Airlines just wrapped a fleet-wide premium cabin refresh. More than 200 Boeing 737s, 650 days, finishing this month.
A 737 every 3 days. That's the pace they kept. And I love this as an operations story because retrofitting a cabin across a flying fleet is brutally hard logistically. You can't take the whole fleet out of service. So you're cycling airplanes out one at a time, doing the work, getting them back on the line, all while maintaining the schedule.
And the product side, they expanded first class, reworked the premium seating.
Which is the competitive reality now. Premium is where the margin is. Every legacy and near-legacy carrier is chasing the front of the airplane because that's where the yield lives. But from a crew standpoint, what I'd note is 200-plus airplanes now have a standardized, consistent cabin. That's good for cabin crew, it's good for boarding flow, it's good for reliability. Consistency across a fleet is underrated.
Now here's one I found fascinating, and it's a government airlift story. Simple Flying dug into a capability gap in the Vice President's aircraft. Air Force Two, the Boeing 757, the C-32A.
Oh, this one's great. Okay, so Air Force Two has been a Boeing 757 variant, the C-32A, since 1998. And the thing about the 757 that nobody appreciates is what an absolute monster it is on performance. It's got huge engines for its size. It's basically a hot rod. Short field capability, can get into airports a bigger jet can't, and it can haul heavy military equipment intercontinentally.
And the problem is?
The problem is, Boeing stopped building the 757 in 2004, and there is no modern airplane that does exactly what it does. Think about it. A 737 MAX or an A321neo doesn't have that combination of short field grunt, plus the range, plus the payload. So when the C-32A finally ages out, what replaces it? There isn't a clean answer.
So you've got a capability that's essentially irreplaceable with current production aircraft.
Irreplaceable with anything you can buy off a line today. And this is actually a thing in the broader market too, right? The 757 replacement question has haunted the airlines for 20 years. The transcontinental, hot and high, long runway doesn't exist missions. Nobody built the perfect successor. And here, it shows up in the government fleet as a national capability gap that, as the headline says, nobody's really talking about.
Let's pivot to something that hits our pilot audience right in the wallet. Simple Flying ran a piece on how U.S. airline pilot salaries can swing by over $100,000 just based on which base you're assigned to.
And this is one of those things that's completely counterintuitive to people outside the industry, so let me set it up. The hourly rate is the same. If you're a first officer on a given aircraft with a given number of years, your pay rate is published, it's in the contract. It's identical whether you're in New York or Phoenix.
So how do you get a 100 grand swing?
Seniority. Relative seniority within the base. Because the base determines what you can hold. Your domicile sets your relative position in the bidding pecking order for that aircraft and that seat. So in one base, you might be senior enough to hold the captain's seat on a wide body, the good trips, the high credit hours, the international premium pay. Move that same pilot, same seniority number, to a more senior base, and suddenly, they're junior, they're on reserve, they're holding a narrow body, they're flying less desirable trips.
So same rate, wildly different annual earnings.
Wildly different. And it's a real career management lesson, especially for our younger listeners coming up. When you're bidding a base, you're not just choosing a city to live in. You're choosing your effective income for the next several years. A junior base where you can hold a better seat can be worth six figures versus a glamorous base where you'll sit reserve. Pilots leave enormous money on the table because they pick the base near family or the fun city instead of running the seniority math.
That's a genuinely useful insight. Commute the seniority, in effect.
Run the numbers before you bid, every time.
All right, here's one that's pure airmanship, and I want to spend a minute on it because it's the kind of thing worth refreshing, no matter how many thousands of hours you have. Simple flying broke down what happens in the cockpit in the 2 seconds before a pilot decides to abort a takeoff.
The rejected takeoff, the reject. And this is one of the highest stakes, most time-compressed decisions in all of professional flying. And the whole point of the article is that the decision doesn't actually start in those 2 seconds. It starts in the departure briefing.
Right. The architecture is built before you ever push the thrust levers up.
That's the key concept. You and your crew establish the criteria beforehand, what will and won't cause a reject. And the big professional discipline is the low-speed versus high-speed regime. Below a certain speed, you'll reject for a lot of things. A caution light, an unusual noise, a config warning. But once you're at high speed, approaching V1, the criteria narrow dramatically.
Because the reject itself becomes dangerous at high speed.
Hugely dangerous. A high-speed reject is one of the riskiest maneuvers there is. You're dumping a lot of energy through the brakes, blowing tires, potentially going off the end. So the briefed standard is that at high speed, you're only rejecting for the truly catastrophic stuff. Engine failure, fire, the airplane is unsafe, or unable to fly. You're not rejecting for a single nuisance caution at 140 knots. You take it airborne and deal with it in the air where you have time.
And that pre-decision is what makes the two-second reaction possible.
That's the whole thing. You can't analyze in the moment. There's no time. So you've pre-loaded the decision. The brief turns a judgment call into a recognition task. See the trigger, execute the response, and the discipline of actually briefing it every single time, not mailing it in on the fourth leg of the day, that's what separates the pros. The reject you brief is the reject you'll fly correctly.
Couldn't agree more. Let's lighten it up, because Simple Flying also had a wonderful bit of engineering history, the SR-71 Blackbird's tires, and specifically why they wore out faster sitting still than landing at 200 knots.
I love this one so much. Okay, so the SR-71, the Blackbird, the tires were made by BF Goodrich, and they were silver. They were infused with aluminum.
Why aluminum in a tire?
Heat. The Blackbird flew at speeds and altitudes that generated insane airframe temperatures, and the aluminum infusion was there to handle and reflect that extreme heat, plus give the silver color to reduce heat soak on the ground. Brilliant solution to an extreme envelope problem. But here's the paradox. Those tires actually degraded faster when the airplane just sat there parked than when it was screaming down the runway at landing speed.
That makes no intuitive sense.
None. But think about it. The tire was engineered for these brief, brutal, high-energy events. Takeoff, landing, done. What it was not optimized for was the slow, steady, mundane reality of just bearing a static load over time and the chemistry of the materials in that special compound. The exotic formulation that survived the extreme didn't love the ordinary, and there's almost a little lesson in there about purpose-built engineering. You optimize for the mission. Sometimes the everyday is what gets you.
The thing that survives the hardest moment isn't always the thing that survives the boredom.
Beautifully put. Write that down.
Let's get back to serious, because there's a security story in here. A man's been indicted after a live explosive device was found before an American Airlines flight at Sacramento.
Yeah, this is sobering. 49-year-old man Kimani Osayande-Jones indicted by a federal grand jury, 3 counts. This was back on May 30th at Sacramento International. And the device, this is the chilling part, was an M-type explosive with a 15-minute timer, plus a knife, scissors, a lighter. He was apprehended before the flight.
So the screening and security layers worked.
They worked, and that's the point I'd emphasize for our audience. The system caught it. But it's a reminder that the threat environment is real and ongoing, and the layered security model, screening, behavioral detection, law enforcement coordination, exists for exactly this. Now it heads into the federal court process. But credit where it's due, this got stopped on the ground.
Let's go north of the border, 2 stories there. First, Porter Airlines and a new airport for Montreal that officially opens today, actually, June 15th.
Right, today's the day. Montreal Metropolitan Airport, the code is Yankee Hotel Uniform YHU. It's the former Saint-Hubert Airport, rebranded, and they've opened a new $450 million terminal. And the whole design philosophy here is fascinating because it's defined by what they're trying to avoid.
Which is?
The headline frames it as building Montreal's second airport without repeating a $30 billion disaster, and that's a reference to Mirabel. For listeners who don't know the history, Montreal built Mirabel back in the 70s as this grand new international airport way out of town, and it was a famous flop. Wrong location, poor ground access, the airlines never fully embraced it, and it basically became a cargo and freight field, a cautionary tale.
So how does YHU avoid that?
By being modest and complimentary instead of grandiose. $450 million, not $30 billion. It's designed to handle up to about 4 million passengers a year, and crucially, it's positioned to complement Montreal-Trudeau, the main airport, not replace it. Porter's anchoring it. It's right-sized. It's the anti-Mirabel. And I think that's smart. The lesson of aviation infrastructure is that the airport that fits demand beats the cathedral that bets on demand showing up.
And second Canadian story, WestJet's network. They're launching 13 new international routes this year.
13. And it's a real geographic spread. Short haul into Latin America, but also long haul into Europe and South America. And the fleet they're flying it with tells the story. Boeing 737s, the 737 MAX 8, and they've got wide-body capability for the long stuff. This is, per the Cirium scheduling data, one of their most ambitious network buildouts in years.
So WestJet pushing well beyond its low-cost domestic routes.
Way beyond. They've been evolving from the scrappy domestic low-cost carrier into something much more like a full network player with international reach. And 13 routes in 1 year is aggressive. The question I always ask with expansion like this is, can the operation absorb it? Crews, maintenance, dispatch, all scaling at once. Aggressive network growth is exciting on a route map and exhausting on the operations floor. But it's a confident move, no question.
And one last lighter one from Simple Flying. They had a feature on FIFA World Cup legends and their private jets.
Of course they did. It's a World Cup year. And look, it's a fun read, but there's an actual market signal buried in the celebrity gloss. High net worth athlete travel has become one of the genuinely visible drivers of demand for large cabin, ultra long range business jets.
Because of the travel patterns.
Exactly. These athletes have brutal international schedules. They need flexibility, they need privacy, and they need recovery time away from the public. So they're buying or chartering the globals, the Gulf Streams, the big ultra-long-range stuff. And it matters to our world because that segment, the elite athlete, the entertainer, it's real, sustained demand at the top of the market. It's not just a vanity story. It's part of what keeps the order books for the big cabin jets healthy.
All right, let's get into the stories percolating up from the community and the safety world, because there are a couple of genuinely important ones. The big one circulating is a preliminary National Transportation Safety Board report with a photo of a Cirrus SF-50 Vision jet that had an uncontained engine failure. And Sam, an uncontained failure on that airplane is notable because of how that airplane is built.
Hugely notable. So the SF-50, the Vision jet, is that single-engine personal jet, the one with the Williams turbofan mounted up on top of the fuselage. And of course, the whole airframe parachute, the Cirrus signature, single engine. So an uncontained engine failure, where engine debris escapes the casing rather than staying contained inside it, on a single engine jet, that's about as serious as it gets in terms of getting your attention.
Now, this is a preliminary report, so we have to be careful. Preliminary means facts as known so far. No probable cause, no analysis.
Right, and I want to be really disciplined about that, because the community loves to jump to conclusions off a dramatic photo. The preliminary lays out the sequence of events as investigators understand it at this early stage. It does not tell you why. The why comes in the final report, which could be a year or more out. So for our listeners, the responsible takeaway is, note that it happened. Watch for any service bulletins or airworthiness directives that might come out of it, and don't speculate on cause.
And from a pure airmanship standpoint, an engine failure in a single is the scenario you train for constantly.
It is, and the SF-50 gives you that parachute option that a conventional single doesn't. Whatever the cause turns out to be, the systems and the training are built around exactly this contingency. We'll keep an eye on it as the docket develops.
Two airline incidents from overseas worth noting. First, a Swiss flight, LX8252 to Ibiza, where the crew performed CPR, cardiopulmonary resuscitation, on a toddler after landing. Successfully.
And then made a really significant operational decision afterward. So the crew successfully resuscitated this child after the aircraft arrived in Ibiza. And then they canceled the return flight to Zurich due to emotional distress among the passengers and the crew.
And I think some people see flight canceled due to emotional distress and don't immediately understand it as a safety decision.
But it absolutely is one, and I want to defend it hard. A flight crew that has just been through a traumatic medical emergency, performing CPR on a small child, that is an enormous adrenaline and stress event. Human factors are a flight safety issue. A crew operating while emotionally compromised is a degraded crew, full stop. Recognizing that you're not fit to safely operate the return leg and standing the airplane down, that is mature, professional, aeronautical decision-making. That's a crew that understands fitness for duty isn't just about alcohol and sleep.
And full credit, they saved the child first.
Saved the child, then made the right call on themselves. That's the whole job.
Second overseas incident, more of a hardware event. Singapore Airlines flight SQ-114, the main landing gear tires burst on landing at Kuala Lumpur. Closed one of the airport's three runways for 6 hours.
Yeah. And a tire burst on landing, on its own, is not catastrophic. Crews handle tire failures, but the ripple effect is the story here. 6 hours, one of three runways out of action. That's the part operators feel. You lose a third of the runway capacity at a major hub for the better part of a duty day, and the delays and diversions cascade across the whole network.
Because the disabled aircraft has to be dealt with before the runway reopens.
Exactly. You can't just sweep it off. You've got to safely move a heavy jet that's sitting on failed gear, inspect the runway for debris, clear it, and only then reopen. And meanwhile, the morning bank is backing up. So it's a reminder that a relatively minor mechanical event can have an outsized operational footprint at a constrained airport. Single points of failure and infrastructure are everywhere.
There was also a good regulatory discussion thread on the rules for using a cell phone in flight, which actually trips up a lot of people because there are two separate regulators involved.
Yeah, this is a genuinely useful one to clarify because people conflate it. There are two independent bodies of law here. You've got the Federal Aviation Administration side, under 14 CFR 91.21, which deals with portable electronic devices and the concern about interference with navigation and communication systems. And then completely separately, you've got the Federal Communications Commission side, 47 CFR 22.925, which is the rule that actually prohibits operating cell phones in flight. And that's a spectrum issue, not a safety of flight issue.
So two different agencies, two different reasons.
Two different reasons, and that's the part people miss. And the FAA rule, 91.21, has a provision, paragraph B, that lets the operator make a determination that a device won't interfere, which is exactly the basis on which airlines approved gate-to-gate use of phones in airplane mode and onboard Wi-Fi. So when you hear, you can use your phone now, that's the operator exercising that determination under the FAA reg. The FCC's cellular prohibition is a separate animal, useful to keep them straight, especially if you're a corporate crew setting policy for your own aircraft.
One more from the community, that's a nice human note. American Airlines offering frequent flyer miles to medical doctors who help out during in-flight medical emergencies.
And the discussion was, is this standard or is it unusual? And the answer is, it's actually a quiet, long-standing practice. American has a formal policy of compensating medical professionals who volunteer during in-flight emergencies with AAdvantage miles, and several carriers do versions of this. It mostly happens out of public view.
And it matters operationally because crews rely on those volunteers.
Completely. When you've got a medical event at 35,000 feet, the "Is there a doctor on board" call is a real lifeline. Cabin crew are trained, they've got the medical kit, they can patch into ground-based medical advisory services, but having an actual physician hands-on is enormous. So a little recognition for the doctor who steps up and spends 2 hours of their flight managing a stranger's cardiac event, that's appropriate. Good policy.
Let's close out with a couple from the video side because there's one piece of pure general aviation gear talk and one sobering safety lesson. The lighter one first. A pilot named Gil, a nurse practitioner, traded his 1990 Mooney M20J for a 19-year Piper Malibu and it's a great real-world look at why people step up an airplane.
And this is such a relatable mission-driven upgrade. So Gil's flying regular New Jersey to Florida trips, and he's doing them in the Mooney, the M20J, which is a fantastic, efficient airplane, but it's unpressurized. And on a long haul like that, you're either down low in the weather and the bumps, or you're up high on oxygen and you're stopping for fuel.
And the Malibu solves all three.
All three at once. The 1984 Malibu, the Continental-powered one, it's pressurized. So now you can climb up on top, above the weather, in comfort. No oxygen cannula. It's got the range to do New Jersey to Florida without the fuel stop. And it's a genuine capability jump. It's arguably the biggest single-engine piston step you can make. You go from a great cross-country airplane to a true traveling machine.
There's a trade-off, though, surely.
Always. The Malibu is a more complex, more demanding airplane to own and operate. Pressurization system to maintain, more systems overall, higher operating costs, and that early Continental engine has its own maintenance reputation. So Gil's not getting a free lunch. He's buying capability and paying for it in complexity and dollars. But for his specific mission, the repeated long pressurized cross-country, it's exactly the right tool. And that's the lesson. Buy the airplane for the mission you actually fly, not the one you imagine.
And then the sobering one to send people off thinking. There's a video revisiting a 2008 fatal crash at Fremont, Ohio, where five people died on a sightseeing flight and the pilot was legally blind.
Yeah, and this one is hard, but it's an important systems lesson. June 2008, a Lions Club pancake breakfast fly-in, the kind of friendly small-town event we all love. People paying $20 for a short scenic ride, and the pilot was legally blind. They crashed on approach, moments from landing, five passengers and the pilot, gone.
And the angle the analysis takes is that this is a failure of the medical certification system.
That's the uncomfortable part, and I want to be careful and fair here. The airman medical certification system is largely self-reporting. You attest to your conditions. And the system depends on honesty and on the network of aviation medical examiners catching what should be caught. When someone with a disqualifying condition slips through, whether through dishonesty or a gap in the process, the consequences can be catastrophic. And in this case, innocent passengers paid for it.
And the takeaway for our professional audience?
A few things. One, the medical certificate is a safety barrier, not a bureaucratic nuisance. The reason we grumble through that exam every 6 or 12 months is exactly this. Two, fitness for duty is personal and professional integrity. The system trusts you to ground yourself when you should. And three, if you're flying the public, even for $20 at a pancake breakfast, you've taken on an enormous responsibility, and the people in your back seats are trusting a whole chain of safeguards they can't see. We owe it to them to keep that chain intact. It's a brutal example, but it's exactly why the standards exist.
A heavy note, but a necessary one. And honestly, that thread of personal responsibility runs through half of what we talked about today. The crew that grounded themselves in Ibiza, the reject you brief, the medical you don't skip.
That's the through line. The systems work when the people in them take the responsibility seriously. The technology, the rules, the procedures, they're all just frameworks. It's the professionals inside them who make it safe.
All right. That's going to do it for this morning. Quick recap. Airbus and Boeing throwing real doubt on the blended wing body while JetZero and Natalis dig in. Flexjet absorbing the jet business in another consolidation move. ExecuJet proving the midlife upgrade is alive and well on the Falcon 7X. Dubai building 400 A380-sized gates. And a couple of safety stories worth carrying with you into your day.
And run the seniority math before you bid that base. I'm still thinking about that $100,000 swing.
You and every first officer listening. For Sam and myself, thanks for spending part of your morning with us.
Fly safe out there, brief your rejects, and we'll see you tomorrow.
This has been Flight Logic Brief. Tailwinds, everybody.